Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's Christmas. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. And of course, we are streaming live on the Countercurrents, DLive, and Odyssey channels. And you just missed him. He was just out the door, but my good friend and co-host arrived. He was covered in chains for some strange reason. And he warned me that I'm about to be visited by three apparitions, by three white nationalists of the spiritual plane who will represent the spirits of Christmas past, present, and future. Now, it was a very strange happening. I hear sometimes happens to old misers, but personally, I'm a bit of a spendthrift, so I don't know why it would happen to me, and I'm still a young man. But you know how these things goes. You got to be careful with the ghosts. You got to be careful with the creatures from beyond the pale. So I've taken the precautions. I've actually structured the show around these three unexpected guests, and we are expecting one of them to be popping in real soon. But before we get to the ghosts, I guess we have some. I mean, it's Christmas, but we still have crass financial concerns to it. Address, because you know it is the season of giving, and this means you should probably donate to Countercurrents. We do have the Entropy stream, Entropy link still up. So if you would just go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, it's going to say we're not streaming, and indeed we are not streaming on Entropy, but we are streaming on DLive and Odyssey, and you can donate there. You can ask me questions if you got questions for the ghosts. I mean, you could probably ask them questions, you know, and if you got questions for me about Christmas and any Christmassy messages, they would be greatly appreciated. And you have, and then you have, of course, Cash App. We can use Cash App. Now you can't ask me questions on Cash App, but you can donate, you can give, out of the goodness of your heart. And because Cash App takes a lesser percentage than Entropy, well, I guess you could, if you just want to give without saying anything, Cash App is the way to go. We're, of course, also taking money through MoonPay. Now, what MoonPay allows you to do is donate with your credit card, and this money gets transformed into cryptocurrency, which ends up in the Countercurrents wallets, and that helps us finance this operation. And of course, another way is through DLive and Odyssey themselves. We are re-lemonized on DLive, and they are quite festive over at DLive. They have replaced the lemons with bells, and they have replaced the ninja geese with ninja sleds. But the ice creams, the diamonds, and the ninjets remain the same, so we are taking all of those. Those are all convertible to cash money, and we will cash them out at the end of the year. See how much money we've made from DLive. And of course, over on Odyssey, you can donate either cash money or Odyssey's very own cryptocurrency, which is the library coin. And we need those library coins to keep video content up on the Countercurrents Odyssey channel. So, you know, they're useful. And I think they're also convertible to money. So on Odyssey, you type out the message and then the donation buttons become active. You got to do the donate, you got to type out the message first. Now, those are all the direct ways in which you can donate to Countercurrents. There's an indirect way, however, and that is to purchase the fine products of our sponsor, Alyaska Chaga. Delicious. Oh, it's still rather hot. Hot tea on a cold winter night, on cold Christmas night. And, of course, if this were the 19th century, I would need to keep tuberculosis at bay, and hot tea goes a long way towards protecting us from such soap opera diseases. But what is that strange moaning sound I hear? Could it be our ghost of Christmas past? Hello, ghost of Christmas past. How are you doing tonight?
Well, hello. Merry Christmas. Good tidings. I guess I could be very 19th century about this, but I'm not interested in the 19th century. Not that kind of past. Okay. I would like to talk about more of the medieval Christmas spirit. I being a ghost of Christmas past, I love the medieval period. I think they did it, you know, in some ways better back then. And I'm going to start by kind of mentioning the beginning of the medieval period. A lot of people associate it with Charlemagne's reign. Charlemagne was crowned emperor in 800 AD on Christmas Day, in fact. And you can expect that there was a lot of reveling happening after that. And afterwards, of course, there were many monarchs who took after that fashion. You've got 12 feasting days just kind of sitting right there, and you're going to use them. But I think the real story here is actually going to be this really lovely Christmas poem. It's often not looked at as a Christmas poem, but it certainly is. It's Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, one of my personal favorites. You've had Wicard on before. He could probably go into at length about this lovely poem, rather short. Wouldn't take very long to read, but it's filled with a sense of the medieval Christmas spirit. And I think it has some lessons that we could all learn in the white nationalist movement today. And if you start reading the poem, it's from the get-go. It starts by linking Britain to the wider Western world. So it talks about Western man as having this unbroken lineage, starts out by talking about the fall of Troy, then Aeneas and Rome, and then it goes on into Tuscany, Lombardy, Gaul, and finally the Britain of King Arthur's day, which is where this is supposed to take place, and when it's supposed to take place, at Camelot. In King Arthur's court, this is a 14th century poem, by the way, and written by a poet in the Midlands. So the same century as Chaucer, but slightly different Middle English. It looks slightly different when you're reading it. But some great translations out there. J.R.R. Tolkien has a wonderful translation. Of course, he was very interested in a lot of this Middle English and the way that these languages kind of developed, these Anglo-Saxon languages, as well as, you know, he was also very Catholic. That's pretty well known. But very interested also in sort of these northern myths and some of the continuities that Christianity kept of some of our pagan traditions. And this is also not just a Christian poem, a Christmas poem, but also one about the solstice too. And I'll go into that a little later. So, but it starts by talking about this unbroken lineage that Western man has. It links Eastern Europe, Western Europe, Southern Europe with Northern Europe. And I do think that that's important, that we all kind of share in this sort of Christmas spirit, because we're all in this together, white people all over the globe, you know, in Eastern Europe, you know, and then through the Anglosphere, where I'm coming from and where this poem came from. So it's talking about Arthur's Britain, Camelot at Christmastide is what it uses. And what I like about it is, like all good Christmas stories, and like the Christmas story this podcast is based on, it's kind of got a darker supernatural sort of edge to it too. So I've written about it before, not in a Christmas way, but it's a haunted horseman ghost story kind of it starts out as. And central to it is this medieval symbolism, and they loved colors in the medieval period because they couldn't make colors all that bright in their regular everyday world. So when they did get to see these bright colors, it was usually because it was a feast, usually a royal or noble feast like this one that we'll be talking about. And of course, the color right here is green. And green is one of my favorite colors because it has so many layered meanings. It can mean nature, but it can mean unnatural things, very preternatural. So you have this healthy, youthful, natural green, but it's also the color of sickness. It can be the color of death. There's been no living person who's ever been green. But it's also a Christmas color, too. It's very rich. So it has all of these meanings. And all of these meanings are bound up in the Green Knight, who, you know, he's a party crasher, actually. So while King Arthur and his knights, who are pretty pleased with themselves, celebrating the Christmas season, pretty prideful in their perfection, and they're just having a pretty good time. It's one of the 12 days of Christmas. I think it's kind of after Christmas, but it's in the medieval period. You had Advent before Christmas, which was a fasting period. And then on Christmas Eve, you started to enjoy yourself. And it was 12 days of revelry where you would have all, you would exchange gifts, you would have dances. And at this court, it was, you know, singularly splendid. And so,
yes, Quithgard has mentioned in the past that Christmas is not just a day, or Yuletide is not just a day, it is a whole period, which can last maybe an entire month. Here in the East, of course, personally, I count the Christmas season from the Feast of St. Nicholas on the 18th of December to the Feast of Epiphany on the 18th of January. But do continue, Spirit. This is fascinating.
Well, and the poem itself takes place almost entirely in the Christmas season. We start out with this taking place, this Noel time, this Christmas tide, and then it goes through the rest of the year very quickly. It speeds on through. It mentions the seasons passing. And then all of a sudden, we're back to sort of these dark days of winter again. And he goes to another court. So what it is, it's most of the action is surrounded and enveloped by a picture of Christmas revelry, and it makes the poem almost this continuous Christmas celebration, which is another reason why it's such a great Christmas poem or to read at Christmas. So he storms in, this green knight. He's truly a huge person. And he's on his horse, has not gotten off his horse. And here I'll mention that this was also a medieval kind of fetish. They really loved it during feasts, and especially at Christmas time, they would play act. They loved to dress up as different people, and they'd have these, you know, people who were known to them, noblemen who were known to them, but would act like strangers, would put on their helmets, and maybe array themselves in this strange garb and say, oh, yes, I'm a knight from such and such territory, very far away, you know, like the terrestrial deserts of, you know, like the, you know, Egypt or some very far away place, made up place, mythical place. And then they would challenge people to sort of a game, a Christmas goemon or a Christmas game in the poem. And this Christmas game is a beheading game. And again, the medieval people loved beheading games. I don't know. It's just, I've thought about this actually. And you look at it even in Tudor courts, they loved to play act people getting beheaded, sometimes a couple of days before the actual person was going to be beheaded. Very kind of dark sense of humor. And I think it has to do with the fact that this was just kind of a given. You didn't really get anything in the world without somebody else dying. I think, unfortunately, that's sort of the darkness aspect of this. So you weren't going to get ahead at court. You weren't going to inherit anything unless somebody close to you, friend, relation, died. Their relationship with death was somewhat different and perhaps twisted in our view, but this was sort of reality. So he comes in and he wants to play this Christmas beheading game. And he, you know, he says, whoever takes hold of this axe, and he's brought with him this huge axe. In his other hand, he has a sprig of holly, very very seasonal. I don't know about the axe, but he says, I will give this axe to whoever wants it, and they can deal me a blow on my neck and lop off my head, okay? And this is the only stipulation. If they do this, they have to let me deal them a return blow exactly a year from now. This sounds kind of crazy. And they all say, well, no, I don't think so. This is really crazy. They're just kind of staring at him. And he goes, well, if this is the perfect court of King Arthur, you know, virtuous and good and, well, manly and brave, then surely someone is willing to take this up. And he starts to make fun of King Arthur. Well, the king gets super mad at this, of course, as he would, and he starts to take up the axe. But lo, here comes Sir Gawain, who is a relation. And he says, no, I'm going to do it because I am no good at all. I'm the least of the numbers here. And I'm only important because I'm related to you, the king. And it would be no loss if I were to die in this contest. And of course, this is meant to sound virtuous and good. But of course, in the poem, you are given to understand that it is false humility. Because he is kind of a prideful man. He's known far and wide as being the perfect knight Gawain. But Arthur, of course, lets him have the go at the Green Knight. So he takes up the axe and lops off the Green Knight's head. And well, that's it. You know, nobody, the party's over. They'll just have to, I suppose, bury the body. But, you know, it's the medieval period, so they have people for that, even at Christmas. But lo, the Green Knight gets up, grabs his head, and says, I'll see you next year, and then storms out of the castle. Everyone's a little surprised, but they go back to their partying, you know, and as does Gawain, because they're trying to act like, well, this is no big deal, and besides, it's a whole year away. Well, then the poem goes through this next year very quickly. Suddenly we're at Michaelmas, and then suddenly we're at All Saints Day, which, as we all know, is the very end of October, the beginning of November. So it's the start of these dark nights, shorter days, and it's getting on towards, you know, the Christmas season, and he has to leave. So everybody kind of bids him farewell. He puts on his armor. And his armor, if you're given to understand, signifies the perfection that he thinks that he has. Specifically, the pentacle that he wears. It's the five-pointed star, which is kind of the everlasting knot that they call in England. It signifies, you know, virtue, knightly courtliness, things of this nature. And it just kind of reinforces the fact that this court is, you know, pretty complacent and proud of itself. And doesn't really have any need for the grace of Christmas. They haven't consciously thought so. But this is kind of what this court is saying. And Gawain is, of course, a representative of this court. And he has this date with the Green Knight. He doesn't even know where the Green Knight is. The Green Knight is told to find the Green Chapel. So he leaves right after All Saints Day to find the Green Chapel in time. Of course, he has some adventures out in the wilds, on the fells, on the crags, and it kind of gets into this, you know, some darker elements as well. Finally, when he's at his limit, he finds a castle on Christmas Eve. And he thinks, okay, well, at last, I found somebody. Maybe they can point me to where this very handsome, burly lord who's there. And, you know, of course he has this very, very beautiful wife as well. And they say, well, you should just stay until your New Year's Eve appointment with the Green Knight. And so again, we're kind of in the midst of this Christmas revelry. And the host, Lord Vertilak, is his name in the poem. He goes out every day on the hunt. If you guys like, I know that you have kind of an interest in, I guess, consuming meat, I suppose. I'll put it like that. But it goes into the hunt quite a bit. So some people should like that and find that kind of, well, it's, you know, still very medieval too. It's kind of imagery. But he makes him a deal. He says, okay, Gawain, I will give you everything that I get on the hunt. You know, we'll exchange everything that we get during the day. And you can stay here and make Merry Christmas at my house. My wife will entertain you. And whatever you get at the end of the day, you will give to me. So we'll just exchange presents, so to speak. So on the first day, the Lord goes hunting and he catches a bunch of deer, a bunch of stags. Brings them back. Well, during the day, what do you do to test a man's mettle? You send a beguiling woman, don't you? This has been the downfall of more than one man. And this is the test that Gawain has, this very beautiful wife of the Lord, goes and tries to seduce him and test his mettle and gives him kisses, okay, which at the end of the day, Gawain has to give back. You know, he resists her advances, tries to be polite about it, okay, because this is, you can't be harsh about it. That would not be courtly. Right. But still, you must resist. So a couple of days this goes on. And on the third day, she, presses him until he says, no, madam, things like this. She says, well, at least take this. It's a green girdle. And guess what this green girdle can do? It can protect you from any blow that is dealt to you in the future. And he thinks, well, I'm about to go have a date with the Green Knight who's going to try to lop my head off. I should take this girdle, this green girdle. And so he does. When it comes time to exchange gifts, he does not give his lord the green girdle. He keeps it for himself because he thinks he needs it tomorrow for his date with the Green Knight on New Year's Day. New Year's Day comes, he leaves, he finds the Green Chapel, and the Green Knight is there. And the Green Knight prepares to deal him a blow. He swings the axe down, then stops it. Once Gawain flinches, and he says, you flinch. You are not this fearless, perfect knight that is this Gawain who has come to see me. Your reputation precedes you. You cannot be Gawain. And he says, fine, do it again, and I will not flinch. So the man, the Green Knight, raises the axe, brings it down. He doesn't flinch, but still nothing. And Gawain gets angry. He says, just do it, man. So the Green Knight raises his axe again, brings it down, hits his neck, but only nicks it. So there's a little bit of blood that falls. And this was all that was needed, a return blow. So the deal's been completed. He gets no more blows. And Gawain thinks that he has cheated death in this way. And the knight says, well, I gave you a nick because you were good in everything except this last thing. You know, you wanted to spare your own life. So you took this green girdle and you didn't keep our pact. He reveals himself to be the lord of the castle who was in disguise. And you fended off my wife who was in on this kind of trick. you were imperfect, sir, in this. And you thought that you were, you know, this virtuous, good person, and he still is, he says. But you still have need of the grace of Christmas. And I think that's where I think the lesson comes in. I would say that we are the Green Knights in this tale. So Western man has unfortunately fallen and degraded himself. He has established this rich, prosperous, glittering court, very, he thinks, secularly moral, sure that he doesn't need grace, a reminding of the past, very prideful, sure in his view of this moral perfectionism that he has. So when people like us enter as party crashers, questioning them about this perfect, utopian, very affected white anti-whiteness, they get extremely offended. You're ruining the party. You're calling into question their goodness, their pride. And they'll call you a bunch of names, and they may even try to lop your head off occasionally. But we need to remind our people of their misplaced pride in their own goodness, which is predicated on denigrating their own race, denigrating their own past and ancestors. We're going to have the last word, though, even though we're going to get yelled at and attacked. We're going to deal the last blow to this incredibly stupid worldview that has taken over the courts of Western countries. And I think kind of all of this might, like King Arthur's court, this pride, might be a product of our own success. Sometimes, unfortunately, we have been very successful in the past, and there's a lot that we should be prideful about. But I think we kind of need to step back and realize that, of course, the poem is about Christian grace. It's about, you know, what is the Christmas season for? That's the question that all good Christmas tales ask. Your Charles Dickens is about learning to keep the Christmas season well, right? It's about how Scrooge learns to do that. And in the Victorian period, it was predicated on family, on giving, on being charitable. In the medieval period, it was about accepting grace, accepting that we are not perfect, man is fallen, and death in the form of the Green Knight causes us fear. But the reason for Christmas is that we have an answer for that. And I think whether you are a Christian or a white nationalist who is not a Christian, pagan or secular, whatever, I think that we still need to act like we have the answer. We are presenting the white nationalist community and white people in general the specter of their own demise, of their own failings. And that's not going to be popular. But after all, the Green Knight has the best outfit, best getup, and the best lines in this play. And like I said, we're going to have the last word. We also have to remind ourselves that our role in this is not just to attack this pernicious ideology, but it's the salvation of our people. Very literally, the salvation of our people. And I think most Christmas poems, this one especially, is about that. And if we want to talk about the solstice, it's about light being challenged by darkness. Festivities can sometimes bring out aloneness, loss, regret, even death, because winter is a time of dying. And, you know, the Green Knight represents death because he's confronting this young court and this virtuous knight with its prospect amid all of this rejoicing. But it's also about venturing out into greater light. If the poem is one of continuous darkness, seasonal-wise, this ever-present winter, and the lengthening of the night and the shortening of the day, and this contest is literally looming over Gawain's head during this entire period, this prospect of death, the new year comes, when this challenge is made. And he emerges tested, cut down to size, but with fewer things obscuring his vision, greater self-awareness, ready to begin renewed. It's kind of the sacrifice that you've talked about a lot in some of your own essays. This sort of replaying of this ritual, and then you emerge from the new year with a new vision, strengthened, renewed, and of course, the lightening of the days is also beginning. So that is the story that I will leave you with, audience.
Thank you for that riveting tale, Spirit. Well, actually, it's Catherine. So I guess the cat's been out of the bag for some time now. But our ghost of Christmas past is Catherine, and she's a treasure of countercurrents. One of the, I don't know if you're a professional historian, Cat, but you're the kind of person who makes history come alive, which is more precious maybe than. And because anyone can crack open a book, and not everyone can track down history by the hard task of the archivist and of the researcher and archaeologist. But everyone can open a book, but not everyone can spin a yarn about the past, both true and fictional. Of course, the fictional is sometimes more true than true because it has been stripped away. Because all of the boring parts have been stripped away. Hitchcock was fond of saying that drama is life with the boring bits cut out. And he was, I believe, right. The drama of the Green Knight, it is a story of a court growing complacent, but a brave knight not willing. And, of course, he has a spirit of self-deprecation there. The greatest of knights is also the most humble. Humility is a virtue which has been forgotten in the West and by white people. And of course, I have written about this in the past, that in our homes with the central heating and with our abundance of food, we have forgotten that for our ancestors, winter meant death. On the 23rd, which is the shortest day, my eye lingered on the sun as it went down, because I can see the sun go down from my house. I do have that privilege of having a westerly window. And I took the 15 minutes right there to stand guard as the sun went down, because I realized I'm witnessing a fold in time, the way we reckon time is sometimes arbitrary, but the solstice, the shortening of the days, the lengthening of the nights, and of course, you know, that longest night of the solstice, it's not really arbitrary. It is a physical fact, and I believe our ancestors were completely, completely impressed by it in ways which I don't know if we can fully understand, not from where we stand, not from our age of abundance and safety. But very soon, as you have mentioned, the specter of death will return to the lands of the West. And we are here to reintroduce the fact of death, because that is the only way in which to re-stimulate the growth of life. The possibility of racial or biological extinction, it's a grim proposition. Maybe it's not fit for the Christmas table, but unless we suffer the discomfort and awkwardness of warning our kin that we are about to die, all of us, and we will be replaced by nothing, then we have no way of saving them.
And I think that is something... also Scrooge's appointment. That was the whole point. You are going to die, sir. Okay, you are going to die, and you need redemption. Okay. The entire West needs redemption. I think that's exactly what the Green Knight was trying to tell these young partying fools. And don't get me wrong, there is a time and a place for games and making merry and having a great time at Christmas. I myself have a party to crash in just a bit in the next hour. I have to put on my green dress, my green party dress, and go over there. Hopefully no blows will be struck. But yeah, that's where I'm heading. So I'm going to have a lot of fun. But as always, I've really looked forward to talking to you. And since the cat's out of the bag, I really appreciate you having me on again. And I'm looking forward to what the other ghosts in this podcast have to say. They're very wise, I'm sure. So
yes,
thank you so much.
We have the best ghosts lined up for soon. Now, we do have donations. People have been donating. They want to keep the Christmas Ghost Fund well-stocked. And we have Hopper Perspective donating five diamonds. And he says, Merry Christmas. And he also donates 12 bells, symbolizing the 12 days of Christmas, and 7 ice creams. And I don't know what that symbolizes, but thank you very much, Hopper Perspective. He's a friend of the show. He's a friend of Countercurrents. I salute you. And he is one of these modern-day knights. I hear he totes guns around rather than an ox, but you got to move with the times. Oh, don't forget your axe spirit when you go out carousing. I personally am a Warhammer type, but to each his own, I guess.
Yes, I'd rather carry my Hollysburg instead, but you do have to lug around these things. So, thank you so much.
The burdens of duty, huh?
Yes. Merry Christmas. And
Merry Christmas, spirit, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, now we have another donation from Norse Nature. And he has donated 1 diamond, and he says, God Yule, and Merry Christmas. I don't know how to pronounce the old Anglo-Saxon language, so I just got scolded by Hvitgerd. I should call him Hvitjard, right? It's Hvitjard, not Hvitgerd. But I pronounce all these things in the German manner because, well, I speak German and not old Anglo-Saxon. And over on Entropy, we have Gadius Maximus donating for 10 American dollars. A Merry Christmas, Macedonian Madman Nix and Talented Texan Cat. That's very creative, Gadius. Thank you. And a Merry Christmas to you too, friend. Overwhelmingly awesome Ohioan, Gadius. Okay, I'm not feeling very creative tonight. But I do hear another spirit moaning at my door at this late hour, and I do believe it is the Ghost of Christmas Present. How do you do, Ghost of Christmas Present?
Ooh, Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, Ghost of Christmas Present, and welcome to the show. And Because you know, since the special effects budget is kind of low over at Countercurrents, you have taken the form of Jim Goad.
Yes.
Quite an apparition, I might add. Mm-hmm. So, have you any fine words for our audience tonight?
I hope it's warmer where you are than where I am. We had a wind chill of -5 degrees Fahrenheit yesterday, which is probably, I don't know, 20, 30 below Celsius. It's been insane here. People think it never gets cold in Georgia. It gets cold in Georgia.
Right, right. And Georgia is, of course, part of the spiritual, the ethereal plane for the time being, I would think.
Ah.
But it is, how cold in Celsius? -30? Are you kidding me?
Let me get the Fahrenheit to Celsius converter here.
-30 is Siberia weather.
Yeah, let's see. It's been crazy. We had the cyclone bomb. -5 Fahrenheit is -20.5 Celsius. Yeah, that's what it was here. That's the wind chill.
-25?
20.5, almost 20 and a half. 20,
Jesus.
21. Yeah, it's been nuts. It's some kind of omen or portent.
Right.
It's the coldest Christmas on record, I believe, in Atlanta at least.
How is the diversity handling it?
I don't know. And they have the big nostrils that takes all the cold air in. It's got to be hell.
Wow.
Because yeah, I had a pug with like the negroidal nose, and she would get overheated in summer because the hot air goes straight into the lungs. But I guess it's the same way with the cold too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, minus 20. People are saying in the chat, minus 20 is pretty cold, but nothing to write news about. When we have minus 20 degrees here in Macedonia, that's nothing, but that's Georgia, right? It's a tropical location. So,
yeah,
you know, you got to adjust this. And in case you're wondering, I think it was like 11, 12 degrees Celsius. So, a day more properly belonging in October today in Macedonia. I was overdressed in my sweater and everything. It wasn't pleasant. But wow, that's frightening. Now, Jim, I mean, Ghost of Christmas Present, I have invited you to share the story of Christmas Present with our audience, since you write the worst week yet every week after week for counter-currents.com. And I thought, well, who else is better acquainted with our current predicaments than someone who, well, essentially writes about them for a living? So I want to ask you, what do you think were the defining events of 2020? Not just in the sense of which events will be remembered or which events had the greatest impact, but which do you think were the most important and the ones we should pay the most attention to as white nationalists? I know you're not a movement guy, but do wear this hat for me, please.
Okay, I got my Santa white nationalist hat on. I'm not sure what to say. I'm not sure. I mean, I know, you know, people online live predominantly in echo chambers. I'm not really sure what goes out in the real world. I've held the opinion for the last 5 years, at least, that we're not going to do much. It's going to be adverse conditions that are really going to put people over the line. That's at least what changed me, is just bad experiences with non-whites. But I'm not really sure. There still seems to be there's all kinds of bitter divisions, what, over the Ukraine war, over religion. I think the powers that be have done a good job at keeping everyone at each other's throats. I wish it wasn't that way, but I'm not sure. And I don't poke my beak into it too much, so I'm not really sure. I mean, some people are optimistic. I guess we did better raising funds this year than last year, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure that there's really a direction. I guess there was Kanye West, but I think the fallout for that's going to be much worse than good. Anyone who thinks he has a chance of president is insane. And he has a lot of the prerequisites for them to just completely dishonor him and just dishonor, link him, who's obviously mental, to the topic of questioning Jews. I don't think it's going to be a good thing in the end. But I'm a contrarian, right? And a grump and a black pillar and everything else. But I can't see anything good coming from that, or anyone who attached themselves lamprey-like to Kanye's public naming of the Jew.
Maybe we shouldn't attach ourselves lamprey-like. Maybe we should cautiously follow the slipstream. Maybe we should cautiously back away before there is a massive explosion. But lamprey behavior, I'll leave that to the lampreys. I remain a Kanye skeptic, as the audience probably knows by now. And if not for Dr. Greg Johnson's spirited defense of the Kanye support, I would probably share your opinion, Jim. But for the time being, I would like to see these two opposing opinions hashed out in debate. I've been trying to arrange it myself. There hasn't been any luck. Progress has not yet been made. And he seems to have fizzled out a little bit, old Kanye West, huh?
Well, he surrounded himself with this cabal of serial backstabbers and people who are constantly embroiled in drama and recriminations and, you know, foiling each other's plots. I mean, Milo, come on. How many years ago did he appear with a little It was an orange hard drive saying that this is his vault and he has information on everyone he's ever worked with. And if he needs to, he will undermine everyone he knows. Ali Alexander took over after Milo, probably even more of a scammer. And so what? The white nationalist movement is now led by Ali Abdul Razak Akbar and Kanye West. And no one sees that as a problem. Come on. Like, how online do you have to be to be positive about that? Yeah, I'm positive about questioning things and opening these discussions, but he presents the powers that be with a good opportunity to link it, like I said, to insanity. Someone like Alex Jones, I've felt for a long time. Alex Jones will bring up legitimate topics, but then he'll take his shirt off and his floppy, sweaty boobs will start flapping as he starts screaming. And I think he's controlled up. It's to link the questioning of any kind of power with insanity. And I think that's what they're going to do. And they're real good at doing that. So I'm not sure much good is going to come out of this. It's going to be interesting seeing the people that attach themselves lamprey-like trying to get their little eel fangs out of this. But I don't think that's going to be possible.
Yes, it is interesting. Of course, right, of all people that Kanye West could have tapped to manage his campaign or to promote his political brand, this is not nobody. Like, I knew who Kanye West was in 2006 against my will, I might add. I did not want to know him. It was a little bit like Michael and Fredo in 2. I don't want to know you. I don't want to know of you. But sometimes you don't really get a choice in the matter. And of all the people he could choose, he chooses Milo Yiannopoulos. The centerpiece of your campaign to red pill America on the Jewish question is the Jew, Milo Yiannopoulos.
People, that's debatable. That apparently, I think his grandmother might have been Greek, or I'm not sure who he's claiming Jewish ancestry from, because Yiannopoulos isn't even his born surname. It's Hanrahan. He's Irish. I mean, there are piles of lies surrounding this guy. He used to be gay. You know, he's that's the thing with a lot of these online movements, is people change their social political identities like they change underwear.
Wait, Milo Yiannopoulos, he's not even Greek?
I think he's got some Greek. I think he's primarily Irish.
Wow.
Yeah, well, Hanrahan. But he doesn't push that one. I don't even think Milo's his first name. I think he might have concocted that too. But
another L for the potato eaters. What can I say?
Yeah, I got to claim Milo. Right, great.
Right, that's rather embarrassing. I was hoping that, you know, because of the historical hostilities between Greeks and Macedonians, I could pin Milo on them. But
I mean, even he, all the rumors about him, like, just soaking people for money, and, you know, being given hundreds of thousands, even millions, and then the rumors that he's millions of dollars in debt. Turns on everyone he's ever worked with. Who thought this was a good idea going in? My initial gut feeling, because, I mean, I used to work at the same network as Milo did, was that, and he stated this, I think, to NBC News, his whole goal in arranging this meeting with Kanye and Trump was to destroy Trump because he felt betrayed by Trump. That's his words. I don't know if this is a theory or anything, but that's what he said. That's what he's quoted as saying, so I don't know.
Well,
I'd be glad if Trump.
But in what way would have Trump betrayed Milo Yiannopoulos? I don't think they were ever officially associated with each other in any way.
You'd have to bring the ghost of Milo present on to ask him. I mean, this might be a scenario that's just playing out in his head, but that's what he stated. The other thing too is this might have been a way to set up Kanye West, because you have, and I try to warn people. Laura Loomer, she's the one who bungled the whole Milo. She came in like Rodan, like some Japanese kaiju monster, to prey on the situation too. And she released all these texts where Milo was calling Kanye gay from last summer. I think that had something to do with Milo's ejection. And then they bring on Ali Alexander, who seems 10 times as gay as Milo. He's got convictions for fraud. You know, he never uses his real name. Ali Abdul Razak Akbar is his real name. And he's just so squirrely appearing. Scammy Davis Jr. He's slimy. And it's another really mysterious thing. He's standing on some parapet looking at these crowds. I think there's smoke in the background, January 6th. I approve of this. I do not disavow this. Where are the charges? It all stinks and glows to high heaven. And it's extremely sad to me that people took hope in this. Yeah, it's great to talk about Jews. I'm all about busting taboos and asking questions that should be asked but are forbidden to be. I get suspicious. That's great. But the circumstances surrounding it could almost not be worse. It's just as bad. I thought Kanye was an idiot from the get-go. My friend Sean Tedjarachi, he was rated by Rolling Stone magazine, one of the 25 funniest people on Twitter. He said a long time ago, Kanye West is so dumb, he probably has another brain under his balls so he can walk. And then you hear all these people, he's massively talented. He's dumb as a rock. He's just a convenient Negro for the times. And obviously mentally. And my theory also was that Kanye really never mentioned Jews. He mentioned, I think when Obama was president, that blacks aren't as well connected and don't have the networking capabilities or resources that Jews do. He got in a little trouble for that. But he remained mum on the JQ until a Jewish guy started banging Kim Kardashian. And he spent most of last summer doing claymation death threats against Pete Davidson. So no one brings that up. I think that might have something to do with it, because he's been unspooling publicly about his breakup with Kim Kardashian. I think it might be a little bit of cuckold rage coming out from Mr. Kanye at this point. Then it's not insane to wear the mask. Like, none of this, you talk about bad optics. The only thing worse, he banging Nick Fuentes in the ass while he's saying all this stuff would have been worse. That's about the only thing that would have been worse. I'm sorry, I'm not taking any hope from this.
I'm just trying to process that mental image you've so cruelly put into my head, Spirit. Make it stop. Yeah. But it won't be a Christmas carol unless Scrooge goes through some. You mentioned that at some point, I guess, in one of the Worst Week Yet essays, that we might be seeing another OJ type scenario where Kanye. But at the time, I remained skeptical because I don't think that Kanye has the balls to OJ Kim Kardashian. You mentioned that Milo said he was gay, and I trust Milo's gaydar. There have been rumors swirling around Mr. West that he may be batting for the other team, and no, I do not mean the blacks. And physiognomy-wise, he does look a little bit like the black guy from Fifth Element, a little bit, and bitter experience has taught me not to mistrust my gut about physiognomy. Okay, so Kanye, could he be on the down low, as the brothers like to say? Possibly. Is this whole thing an extended chimp out because he's bitter about being cuckolded by the Jewish guy? Probably. Right? But of course,
I'll speculate, he does not... It's all speculative, and it does. I'm of the mind you can definitely separate the person from what they're saying. You can separate the artist from the their personal behavior entirely. But most people don't look at it that way. And if they can, if he slaughters Kim Kardashian and Pete Davidson, it's not going to look good, and they're going to associate that with a message. Is all I'm saying. I think they could have found a better messenger, but. I think we, in this day, we only get the messengers that we're allowed to get. So I don't think the powers that be are that freaked out that this mental Negro is saying these things. I think they're very happy. And maybe they think it's high time to address black anti-Semitism. Maybe that's the end game of this. And they're going to start whipping them in line. I don't know. I'd like to be optimistic, but hard experience has told me not to be. What's that?
It is entirely possible that blacks the leash that blacks are held on is going to be shortened, because they've been given some license in the past. Farrakhan has never been censored the way white nationalists have been. Even white nationalists who avoid the Jewish question, or people who are not white nationalists or just want immigration restrictions, shudder the thought, have been so heavily censored while people like Farrakhan and Tariq Nasheed are running around rampant. Speaking of Tariq Nasheed, I remember, because I reviewed Buck Breaking for Counterpoints, and that was one of the... I recently I found a sticker pack on Telegram which has a mestizo guy with gynecomastia pouring milk over himself.
Oh, God.
It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And the sensation is similar to having watched Buck Breaking, but I remember in that film, Tariq Nasheed accuses a number of rap industry people, many of them Jews, but one of them Kanye West, that they're trying to turn black men into homosexuals, into that essentially the rap industry is a methodology of roundabout, penetration-free buck breaking. And to people wondering what the hell buck breaking is, it is the act of raping a black buck in order to make him docile, publicly doing that. Now, Tariq says that modern buck breaking takes the form of force feeding black soy in prison, and Kanye West trying to get them to wear skirts, which he did in 2012-11. This period, he was marketing a line of skirts for men. Let that sink in. It's one of these interesting things. I just remembered that about a week ago, now that Kanye's in the news again, that yeah, he was hawking skirts for men at one point. So I would say very interesting set of coincidences surrounding our good friend West.
I guess the Elon Musk thing was another huge thing this year, but I've known more people to be banned since he came on than before. So I have no idea what's going on with that. The one thing you learn after 61 years is don't get prematurely hopeful about anything. You'd like to be. I mean, it sucks being depressed and disappointed and let down and betrayed all the time. But I guess it's a little bit less of a letdown if you don't get your hopes up too much. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess that's the trick to remaining happy. Don't expect anything good and let probability surprise you with what it can do.
Lowering your expectations is the key to happiness. Yes.
I would say that a lot more people put their faith in Elon Musk than they did in Kanye West. Kanye West, outside of the whole Graper scene, I don't think anyone takes that seriously. I hope I'm right. I hope I'm not wrong.
There's tremendous value in it. I don't care if it's Charles Manson bringing these things up. I remember long time ago, like long before he started being boring and unlistenable and insufferable, Howard Stern and his black co-host Robin, they were David Duke. I think he was running for Congress or running for something in Louisiana. And they just started talking about his policies and they paused. And they made comedy out of it, but like, I got to tell you, like, that kind of makes sense. There is a value in shoving these ideas out, no matter who the messenger is. I mean, to open minds, at least. But Sam Dixon, I'm trying to find, I think Ertaby, E-R-T-A-B-Y, was the Hungarian psychologist he was referencing. He said that he once attended a lecture by this guy or by students, acolytes of this guy. They did studies and they crunched the numbers. I'm not sure how you can, like, scientifically determine this, but the conclusion was that only about 30% of people anywhere at any time are willing to question authority, even if given like conclusive evidence that authority is lying to them. People are just naturally that complicit and docile, and you don't even need to medicate them or anything. I think the 30% of people who are pliable as far as changing their minds and being open to the fact that authority is lying to them might be changed by that. The other 70% are going to go along with that, whatever they're told. That's the sad thing I've learned.
That's too high to me.
Huh?
By my own
30% is too high? Yeah.
Yeah, I would say about 20% are open to being convinced that authority may be lying to them. Although, you know, I have noticed that a lot of people are prepared to accept that, the powers that be are dishonest, lying crooks as a general idea. But if you try to draw their attention to specific lies, specific deceptions, specific thefts, and say, we should do something about this, at least get angry, then they become very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And they try to change the subject. And if you press it, they make you out to be the problem. And that's why I don't hang around normal people anymore. I mean, I just don't have the energy. I just don't have the energy to be around these, you know, cattle, to be completely honest. But circling back to Elon Musk, like I said, I think that Elon worship, that Musk worship, that we have more muskrats than juice boxers, right? Because now the Kanye people are identifying themselves with the emoji of a juice box, which, I don't know, it makes sense in their heads. But we had more people who were saying, oh, Elon Musk is going to bring back the free speech of the on Twitter, and he's going to save us, because it's just straight out of the narratives we like to paint for ourselves. You know, you read Thomas Carlyle and he says, oh, a great champion who has been hitherto part of the system, he's going to turn against them and he will approach them with sword not yet drawn, but ready to be drawn, right? Held by the hilt, and he's going to challenge the power, and then it fizzles out like it does. Now Twitter's more censorious than it ever has been.
Tipped me off that something might have been amiss was Elon Musk posted, my personal pronouns are prosecute Fauci. Now, wherever you stand on that, if you believe that Fauci is the demon murderer who slaughtered untold numbers of homosexuals with his AZT in the 80s, and that's a different thing. I was hoping Musk would come on and just not have any agenda, just let people talk. Unless they're threatening to kill one another, let them say whatever the hell they want. That clearly, he has an agenda too. And a lot of things need to be righted, but that's easily corruptible. I would have preferred somebody who was just an absolutist. And again, like, you know, harassment and threats, that's about the only thing that should get you banned. Or, I mean, I get, you know, there are libel laws. If you actually say something provably false about someone that costs them money, yeah, well, just there's your evidence. Let them libel people. That shouldn't even be illegal, at least on his platform. When he started censoring, but, you know, Greg on there for like a couple hours and he was yanked?
Yeah.
And Kanye with the swastika, the Raelian symbol, he got yanked for that. Like going DEFCON 3 on Jews is not as bad as the symbol. There's no consistency to any of it, so I'm not sure.
It's probably the biggest disappointment of 2022 in terms of, I would say that I was skeptical of Elon Musk from the get-go now, because, and I don't really have a crystal ball, but I am a keen observer of social trends. And I noticed all the wrong people getting excited about Elon Musk, you know, libertarians, neo-reactionaries, the Bronze Age pervert people, all of these people who are desperate to avoid talking about anything except race, and especially about race as it relates to the survival of white people. And if these people are excited, rightly or wrongly, that's a red flag for me. And now it turns out that, okay, my worst fear that Elon Musk would set up a hothouse, set Twitter up as a hothouse for the fake right, that turns out to have been unfounded. What's transpiring is that, oh, he's actually impotent in the face of the ADL, which is, I would say, a less bad outcome than him successfully setting up a successful hothouse for the fake right. But it's not exactly a good outcome, is it?
He's got a good sense of humor. I think stuff like such as the Twitter files, like revealing that the feds collaborated with the FBI, with Twitter to suppress information leading up to the election, that's all great. If you believe that elections really matter, I'm not sure about it. But, you know, I'm all for the free, unfettered transfer of information. Obviously, they were tampering with that, but they're tampering with it in a new way. And it seems like a bunch of false hope. I don't know. Otherwise, as far as white nationalist movement, what else happened this past year? I think people are gradually getting sick of, I think white people will turn when there's deprivation and when their kid gets beaten up at school by non-whites, stuff like that, I think. Unfortunately, you know, as propagandists, whatever we consider ourselves, I don't think we're as pivotal in this. I think real life negative experiences are going to be much more. I mean, with me, it was a combination of bad experiences plus just realizing things, then hearing them articulated. For example, was the bell curve came out when I was interviewing all these rappers and thinking to myself against my, you know, counterintuitively thinking, God, this guy's dumb. And then this guy's dumb. And then here comes all this wealth of information sort of documenting that. Also, when I talked to Tom Metzger and I was all I was about as left, you know, as down with the cause as it can get. And he said, well, I don't believe in equality. They say all men are created equal. I laughed. No one in power believes that. And I had no comeback for that because I knew in my guts it was true. So again, there are positives to getting this information out there, but we shouldn't get too hopeful. And it's good. Well, yeah, it's good not to be around normal people.
Another thing people like to say is that the vast majority of people already agree with us, and that's actually true. The thing is, right, these people don't know how to articulate that. Now, if you
they don't have the guts to reveal themselves either, which is a problem. That's a huge thing. And I know
it's also a problem of articulation. Like maybe you have a problem, like, you know, in your heart that, yeah, blacks are beating up your kids and that you would rather have a white neighbor than a black neighbor and that you would rather do a business with a white man than with a Jew. But you don't know how to articulate it or are too afraid, or it just is not, it's not, it does not detract from your best life in such a way that you would complain. It's a thing, right? I think society in general has a degree of problem tolerance, an amount of problems which it can absorb in stride. And you're right, this threshold has to be tripped at the individual and the societal level. Obviously, localities will sometimes experience these problems. But on the other hand, if this threshold is broached, it's crossed for the individual or the community, right? And there's no one to articulate the problem and there's no one to offer a solution, people will just persist in their folly. That's something I've observed, you know, in the business world, actually. If people are taught a certain way of doing things, then they come across a problem in which the old methodology does not work and they cannot get good guidance from authority. They're just going to try to implement the old solution. And it's like
they'd prefer someone else to take the risks.
Have you seen those cleanup robots, the Roombas?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know how they keep smacking into an obstacle they cannot clear? Right. Yeah. They keep attempting it. It's like we said, those 70 or maybe 80% of the population, which will not go against authority. If you do not give them an alternative solution to a problem, they're just going to keep smacking into it with the old. They're going to try and solve the race question with libertarianism, with liberalism, with conservatism. God help you if you're trying to solve it to conservatism. And we're the people coming up with the new solution. So no, it's not us red pilling them; they red pill themselves.
But we're also the people making ourselves targets, and that's what I resent about the people who don't allow themselves to become targets. Because boy, do they run their mouths, but they're waiting till like the front lines get massacred, and it's safer to step up. And that's what I resent about them, because it's a weird position to be in, where you're taking all the hits and you have these anonymous people with screen names saying that you're not going tough enough at this, or you know, purity spiraling on you. It's like, you don't even have the guts to tell me who you are. And don't get in these whole lectures about what you can risk. I've risked it all and have suffered a lot because of it. I don't want to hear that. And the point I'll make again, I understand why people are anonymous. At the very least, you should revoke your card to criticize someone who doesn't remain anonymous with any kind of cowardice. Because not revealing who you are is fundamental cowardice. Yeah, and again, I know the risks and I've taken them. And I was in the 90s getting canceled for speaking the wrong thing. So yeah, I bear a grudge against the anonymous shit talkers who will try to purity spiral. For an example, this happened like God, it was after Obama got reelected, beat Mitt Romney, and I did an article for Tacky Mag called 10 Reasons You Probably Shouldn't Assassinate Barack Obama. And one of the, it mentioned one of the reasons, it mentioned some Zionist alleged conspiracy. And someone in the comments with a fake screen name said, well, it's kind of interesting that in number 7, you didn't mention this Zionist conspiracy. And I'm like, look, did you click the link in what you're quoting that you said I didn't mention the conspiracy? Because if you'd click the link, that's exactly what it links to. It's like, I don't know, Jim, you're still dodging. It's like, I don't know who your name, like, it's like everyone's a prank caller now. And would risk free. And it's like, I understand, but like if you dare to impugn anyone who isn't such a coward, you should probably be shot. Theoretically, in a video game.
Yeah, it is interesting, right? And people have commented that online anonymity is dangerous. Frody Midyard, he's gotten a lot of mileage out of this term, the Jerry Springer right? Because, and you mentioned Alex Jones, we spoke about Kanye West, we spoke about Nick Fuentes, Milo Yiannopoulos, all of these people. I think the combination of anonymity and this approach, I hate the term infotainment. I don't hate the term. I hate the concept of infotainment, even though I am technically an infotainer with the writer's block. But this whole idea that political analysis exists to entertain. No, it doesn't. It doesn't exist. You're trying to accomplish something, politically speaking. Even if it's just keeping the public informed, you know, you're not there to entertain. Politics is not a joke. It's a fundamentally serious thing. This is one of the great insights we get from Carl Schmitt. When you do politics, people die. That makes it fundamentally serious.
Clearly life and death.
These people are, they're treating it like a video game. They're treating it like, I've had this said to me, like, you're not fun. Like you're boring. You're not funny. I'm like, am I supposed to entertain you? Am I supposed to be funny like the clown? You know, like the Joe Pesci thing from.
I disagree I think you're funny, but I think that it's important to present these ideas because, like you said, it's life and death. But it's much more effective if they're presented in an engaging or entertaining way. To the people who, I mean, there are people who are just dry autistics who can just be persuaded by facts, but that's not how you rope a lot of people in. So I think there's a value in both approaches. But yeah, Jerry Springer, where it's this.
Be boring, but there are people who are drama first.
You know? Yeah, but nothing but that. But that's the thing.
Anonymity fuels a lot of that. Anonymity fuels a lot of the Jerry Springer approach. And people expect to be entertained by this sphere, which, you know, we are discussing grave matters. I just had Catherine on and she spoke about the Green Knight. He's going to cut your head off in a year. That's a fundamentally serious question. We're in a very similar predicament as white people.
Yeah. No disagreement at all. But as far as the drama, I don't think anonymity prevents people from getting into that. It actually encourages people to, and I've had this so many times where someone says, well, you know, Thomas Paine and Ben Franklin use pseudonyms. Yeah, I understand. But if you could actually break it down statistically, how many anonymous people are actually revealing nuclear secrets and how many people are saying Richard Spencer's ex-wife has herpes? Like, how much of it is just drama and they're doing it because they're anonymous? And how much are they actually like fighting the power, speaking truth to power, any of these cliches? I bet you it's overwhelmingly your wife has herpes. And then they just don't want the repercussions. And it's because they grew up with video games and parasocial relationships. And you could hit them over the head with a baseball bat and it would remind them of a Star Wars movie. That's a serious problem. This hyper reality or not, just state of uncanny valley reality that most people live in these days. It's terrifying to a boomer such as me.
Yeah. It should be terrifying to all of us. It should be terrifying to, I'm going to sound very stupid right now, but I keep finding myself flabbergasted by the fact that I turned 30 over a year ago. I'm like, holy shit, there's no going back. Like every video game I've ever played, and I've played a lot of them, you can always turn the system off and start a new game, but not this one. Yeah. I'm never going to be 28 again.
That's terrifying. I was like 18 or 19. I was reading some Edward Albee, some depressing play. And this thought occurred to me, like, one day you wake up and you're 34 and it's too late. You know, I was 18 and that was a terror. Now I'm 61, so I just exist in a state of constant terror.
I guess at some point I hypothetically knew I was going to turn 30 or 40. Jesus Christ. But it had to happen, and it still hasn't sunk in. It's been over a year ago, and it still hasn't sunk in. I don't think I'm ever going to get used to it.
Psychologically, I feel like the same eternal self inside. You just, you know, the car you're riding gets some nicks and dents and, you know, the fan belt snaps and stuff like that. But you kind of feel the same age inside all the time. But when it's 9 degrees out, your bones ache and stuff at a certain age. I think that's the difference.
Yeah.
As far as being hopeful, I'm probably happier than I've ever been in my life, more well-adjusted than I've ever been in my life. And it's just my luck that it happened when the world was falling apart. So who knows what the next year holds. I was going to save it for this week's the worst week yet. I'm probably going to bump it to next week. There's some anarcho-capitalist named Doug Casey. He had a bunch of horrifying predictions for 2023 that I'm probably going to talk about next week. He thinks fiat capital is going to fall apart across the world. He believes that wokeism, you know, and he actually, I'm probably going to cover it this week, Mikhail Kovalchuk, some Soviet physicist who's the brother of Putin's personal banker. I don't know why Putin has a personal banker. He came out with some amazing things about, like, the West is going to have, you know, artificial incubating wombs, and gay marriage is being pushed just so nobody will reproduce anymore, and these android babies are going to make Africans look attractive. It's like, wow. Like, it's some of these things that people are actually saying about the Russian side articulated by a Russian. It was kind of surprising.
That's amazing. That's... Well, you know, libertarians have been predicting the end of fiat capital since there has been fiat capital, or libertarians, whichever came first.
Right.
And Russians are always, they have a very skewed view of the West. I've been looking into this Russian style theory about the world. I'm not going to call it a conspiracy theory because it's called the Golden Billion, where their idea is that essentially the people in the West, the billion people living in America, Western Europe, Japan, South Korea, Australia, et cetera, are the wealthy, have the wealth and the standard of living they have because they stole it all from everyone else. And you think about it, you try to say, no, there are poor people in America, but when you think about it, the poor in America have the same standard of living as the middle class in Russia. And the less said about Africa, the better. But these people are convinced that it's because because I would say Macedonia is a poorer part of this Golden Billion, but we're still part of it, according to them. We stole it all, I guess, in some way or another. So it's just fascinating to me. We do have donations.
I've thought for a long time that people choose the politics that justify their existence the most. And it's a bitter pill to swallow. I mean, imagine, I'm bringing the horror here. I'm a ghost, but imagine the horror of being black and having to realize, well, maybe we were dumb. That's a lot. It would be hard to get out of bed after that. So it's more comforting to say, no, it was stolen. It had to be a man of great honor to say, yeah, we were dumb. But there has to be a little bit of masochism in there or something. You'd almost rather lie to yourself just to keep going. I'm not sure. But yeah, the stole thing, it's like, well, what prevented you from stealing it? Being virtuous? Well, maybe virtue doesn't work in this world. But I think, thievery, it's in the eye of the beholder. Cleverness, I think, has a lot to do with who winds up on top.
It is, I guess, the way it is. Well, thank you for your time, Ghost of Christmas Present. Have you got any closing words before you return to the ethereal plane?
Before I vaporize and go into the land of Nod, I hope everyone's as happy as I feel right now. I realize I'm a turbulent soul, but I found a calm place, and I'd like to share it with whomever wishes to partake of it. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, and thank you for your time tonight, Ghost. I mean Jim. I mean Ghost. Bye bye. And I guess that's our time with the Ghost of Christmas Present. Now, we do have one more spirit to welcome on the show by show's end, but we do also have donations. And we have $14.88 over on Odyssey, Michael57DE, and he says, "Hail Nix and Jim, a wind chill of -5 degrees Fahrenheit is cold for Georgia, but it's nothing for northern Minnesota. We had a temperature of -10 Fahrenheit, which is -23 Celsius, before wind chill, and -34 Celsius with the wind chill. Good Yule and Merry Christmas to you and yours." Boy, am I glad not to live in Minnesota, and not just because of the Somalis. Wow, those temperatures sound brutal. I mean, we've had -20 in Macedonia before, and I enjoyed it, but you know, it only took for like 2 or 3 days before dissipating. I'm not a fan of deep cold winter, if I'm being completely honest. I prefer mild winters, not as mild as this one, because I like to wear my sweaters, but that's fucking cold, man. And we also have, do we have more, any other donations? We have ABC over on Entropy for 10 American dollars. "The national communists have a lot in common with today's alt-right as far as ideology is concerned. It is the international communists that are the enemy of white nationalists. It's better than befriending people like Kanye, who takes stand against Jews simply because they're too white." Comments. No, I don't think I'll ever support breaking bread with communists, because I don't really see communism as an ideology. I think we discussed this on last show with Horace. You're engaging with what they're saying. You should ask yourself, why are they saying it? And they're saying it because they want you thinking about this, so they can pull the wool over your eyes, take over your country, and then impose their disgusting communist genetics on it. Do not engage with these people. That is my advice. Otherwise, you'll never be rid of them. I guess that's your question answered. It has to be brief, because I hear a moaning sound, and it would appear that the ghost of Christmas yet to come is among us. Hello, ghost.
Woo!
Was that I am scared.
Good, yeah.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm dead. How well do you think I'm doing?
Are you Romanian, ghost? Or are you Transylvanian?
No, I'm the host of a cheap Canadian afternoon horror movie show. They call me Count Scary. You don't think that's scary? Woo!
This is my scared face, ghost. I am terrified. I have just urinated all over myself. And number two is not far behind.
I have that effect.
I'm sorry. I need to collect myself. A degree of professionalism may be in order, but it is Christmas, and I am speaking to the dead.
Hmm? Not when I'm the guest. Professionalism goes right out the window.
Exactly.
That's scary.
The ghost of Rick Mayall is with us tonight, and he is going to help us envision the future.
That's true. Right. Let's talk about the past. You know, you missed an opportunity there when you brought up the Joe Pesci thing, because Jim Goad, with that politeness for which he is known, he's known in the field as Mr. Geniality, immediately said, "Oh, you're funny, Nick." And that's at the point where you should have like been quiet for a few seconds and stared into the camera and then said, "What do you mean I'm funny?" You know, like you were actually going to break into that. that thing. Like, yeah, it was a joke until Jim said that, and then suddenly it gets serious.
That exactly.
That would have been good.
I think the humor for that scene comes from the fact that Joe Pesci can indeed use violence against Henry Hill. Because I've learned a long time ago, it was the mid-90s, I believe, that you cannot use violence over the internet. Well, not the real kind anyways. You can use it in the leftist definition, you know, like words of violence and stuff like
that's
that.
Right.
But unless you can actually break the guy's head open, I find that the tough guy act does not usually get things done. So I try to avoid it. Well, it's a conservation of energy thing.
Well, yeah, you know, don't waste your time if they're not going to take you seriously anyway. Let me strike back at that because I think I got this on from the internet actually, so it must be true. It's from YouTube because it's curated, so everything on YouTube is true because you know you'd be thrown off if you said something not true. You need to contextualize that scene because he actually isn't threatening Henry. What's actually going on is that they're playing. It's a routine that they're doing. See, there's a clue towards the end there when everyone's laughing, and I think he's already thrown the champagne thing at the waiter, and so on. Everyone's sort of laughing and horrified, and he says to Henry, "You're supposed to be doing this too, you know." And the idea is that these two have been going into the restaurant over and over again, and Pesci's run up like $7,000, seven big ones owing to him. And they're deliberately trying to create a scene there to scare the owner. And sure enough, in the next scene, we see the scared owner going to Pauly asking for protection. And that's how Pauly gets his hands on the restaurant. So that was actually all planned. That was an act. They were both in on it.
Huh.
That's my contribution. See, now you can't watch that scene the same way. See, now you, when you see it again, you'll realize that they're actually pretending to be doing that. You're supposed to be doing this too, you know, Henry. You know, like hold up your end. They're like an improv group, you know, and you know, in improv, the first basic rule is if you can't think of anything to say, you automatically say yes, but. So Henry isn't holding up his end of the act there, at least Joe thinks. But anyway, that's my.
But that makes it better, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It makes the owner believe that, you know, this guy is so unhinged that not even his buddies can keep him in line.
Well, yeah, that is the problem.
Which is the impression I give. I guess, you know, it's because
my friends,
you know, they break kayfabe and say, hey, stop,
exactly.
"Stop acting right now." I'm like. You're acting? I didn't know that. I really am crazy.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what it is. It, they were doing kayfabe. They were like two professional wrestlers. You're supposed to actually believe. And that's the problem with Pesci because he goes too far. So when he kills Spider, everybody's happy and laughing and they give Spider $20 and they're clapping him on the back and saying, you know, it's like the earlier scene when Henry gets arrested and they say, oh, you broke your cherry, you know. And they're all, oh, look at this guy. He's become a real tough guy. He's talking back to what's his name? And all that. And everyone's like, and Pesci is just sitting there stone-faced, and he pulls out his gun and kills him. And De Niro says, why did you do that for us? We was only funning with you, and so on. And, of course, that's exactly what he does to Billy Bats. You know, hey, I was just breaking your balls a little. You know?
So I don't remember. I only saw Goodfellas once.
Oh, my God. Oh,
yeah. I remember the scene where what's his name? Joe Pesci. I forget the character's name. I remember the scene where he gets whacked. I remember Lorraine Bracco. She's Jewish, right, in the film. yeah. I remember his name? I remember the funny like a clown scene, but yeah. Otherwise I really did not find it all that impressive. I knew that Lufthansa is somehow involved.
Yeah. They're always involved in something.
I don't know. I don't really I did not find it all that impressive a film. Everyone's like, oh, you should watch Goodfellas. It's the ultimate guy film. And I'm like, no. And this is from someone. It's not that I don't like mafia films. I've seen Godfather like 25 times. But one, two, I've seen it maybe 15. Three, twice. And I regret those times.
It's about that's a normal percentage, I'd say. That's about how it breaks out.
I don't know. It's just I don't find it all that impressive.
You know what? I would partially agree with that because I think Casino is ultimately a better film.
Yeah, yeah. What was Casino the one where Joe Pesci gets buried alive?
What happens to Joe? Yeah, that's the one where he's buried alive. Yeah, in the cornfield.
Right. So I preferred that one. I only saw it once on television. I never really got around to watching it properly. But I do remember that scene where he's beaten with the metal clubs and buried alive along with his brother. It's been I saw it when I think I was 4, maybe 5, maybe a little older. Anyways, no, I was old enough to know that the babe was hot. So I guess I was 6. Doesn't matter. Oh, we have Jim Goad in chat saying, I think the best Scorsese movie was The King of Comedy. I agree. I actually think that is Scorsese's best film.
That could be.
That is indeed a correct opinion to hold. I like the one because it's forward looking. It predicted the rise of the socially atomized, socially dysfunctional man who thinks he's hot shit. it would appear that this archetype has dominated discourse both this year and many past years and will dominate discourse for some time to come. But Ghost, I have invited you on because you are known to posit that the future can be made better by positive thinking, by positive visualization. And I think we've had enough trouble and division and misrule and just plain bullshit this year. And I was thinking you could help me manifest a better 2023 into being. So if you will.
Sure. Why not? Since people, I guess, tend to be skeptical, and rightly so, of this sort of thing, I'd like to start by bringing in Jonathan Bowden as my witness. I wrote about this in Countercurrents a couple years ago in a book, which I Am Not a Liberal, from Imperium Press. And which Bowden, they took Bowden to after a New Right meeting to a pub and filled him with beer and recorded it. And so in this setting, he says, I'm looking for the exact quote I want here. The decline is inside and the decline is mental. Only when the mental processes change, all the physical outside phenomena can naturally be reorganized. Not easily, it will be very difficult, but when the mentality is different, everything else will change. What you see around you is the expression of your mentality, not the reverse. Just by adopting a coherent form of thinking, you can actually change reality quite a bit. And that's the idea. That's the idea. As the editor of that collection says in his introduction that... Jonathan looked at his own tabula rasa as a completely clean slate, but instead of allowing the chance happenings of the world to write his story, he would assume complete control. His creative imagination allowed him to recreate and reinvent himself. He recreated himself as the principal antagonist in his own novel. So that's the idea. Now, I've written frequently about a chap named Neville. He went by one name. His name was Neville Lancelot Goddard, which connects us up with the Green Knight, of course. But he referred to himself as Neville in his writings and his lectures from Barbados, like Alexander Hamilton. And he lectured in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Looked kind of like Cary Grant. The ladies flocked to his lectures. Great role model for Aryan youth. Married, two children. Lived a good life in hotels in New York and Los Angeles, going back and forth as his lecture schedule determined. I think of them living there like Lucy and Ricky and I Love Lucy, with you know, plenty of gray suits and cocktails and so on. But anyway, the point is, he developed a what he called a simple method for changing the future. And I've traced it through Blake, through Julius Evola, the Hermetic tradition, Neoplatonism, and so on. These are all very complicated ideas and systems and so on, but Neville boiled it down to a simple three-step method, which I will present to you right now, is to form a clear, detailed picture of what you desire. I wrote an article for Countercurrents called The Devil Made Me Dream It, which compared Neville's method to Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. So this corresponds to Alinsky's rule, pick a target and freeze it. So in other words, our enemies are already using this method. This is the method that works. You'll find that everybody uses it who's successful. Henry Ford, the left, it's all about this. Pick a target and freeze it. Or as Neville says, form a clear, detailed picture of what you desire. Then relax into a state resembling sleep or a controlled dream state. Any kind of withdrawal from action, as Alinsky says. He recommends jail or meditation, Alinsky does. So don't throw our enemies into jail. That just makes them more powerful, as Obi-Wan would say.
And yeah, it's interesting. Basically, the biggest problems for many, like the biggest problem the Soviet Union created for itself was throwing Solzhenitsyn in the gulag. The biggest problem that fascist Italy inflicted on the world is throwing Gramsci into jail.
That's exactly. I was thinking of Gramsci, actually. Yeah, that's an example of it. This is also a method of lucid dreaming, basically, that they didn't have that term back then in the 40s. Then enact a mental scene that contains the assumption and feeling of your wish fulfilled. Run the little drama over and over in your mind until you experience a sense of fulfillment. Or as Alinsky says, personalize it and polarize it until you develop the necessary hostility. But of course, Neville doesn't operate with hostility. He and Evola and so on talk about developing love for the object, for that little scene. You have to over and over.
It's interesting. We should think about Alinsky as invoking a sort of demonic inversion of Neville's method, huh?
Yeah. As Evola says, in order for any image to act in the way I am talking about, it must be loved. And you find that in Silence of the Lambs when they're dissecting the moth pupa. And I said, well, it's from Asia. Anybody raising them here would have had to keep it warm, feed it honey. Somebody loved it, right? So that's the three-step method. since I was designated as the ghost of Christmas future, I thought I would take a look at Christmas Carol. And as so often is the case, if you look at it with the right frame of mind, you discover a lot of Neville in it. So just on the basis of what I've just been outlining with Neville's simple method, what we basically see in the Christmas Carol is Ebenezer Scrooge confronting these various images, these shadows, as Dickens calls them. Shadows that, are, in the case of the Ghost of Christmas Future, are what will be. Now, as we go through the text, and I marked a few passages here just to indicate where this comes up in, right on page 5, Dickens describes Scrooge as not being a man of strong imagination, and so he failed. Then a few pages later, Scrooge had as little of what is called fancy about him as any man in the city of London, even including, this is a bold word, the corporation, aldermen, and livery. So we're presented at first with Scrooge as someone who lacks imagination, or more likely who simply hasn't developed his imagination, because everyone has imagination, what Neville called your wonderful human imagination, which is what you are. You are entirely made out of imagination. So everything around you is a function of your imagination anyway, unconsciously, so you might as well take conscious control of it. It's when he goes in and starts by the fireplace. Dickens describes the fireplace as paved all around with quaint Dutch tiles designed to illustrate the scriptures. Of course, Neville found many of his stories from the scriptures. He read the Bible as a psychological document, not a historical document. If each tile had been blank at first with the power to shape some picture on it, its surface from the disjointed fragments of his thoughts, there would have been a copy of Marley's head on each one. So we see as he gazes at the biblical illustrations, he begins to develop his imagination. He begins to acquire that power. And skip ahead with the ghost, what Marley's ghost tells him is that every Christian spirit is required to go out into the world. And he, Marley, failed to do that. He stayed within his counting house. And this is the idea that your imagination is supposed to be shaping your reality. And Marley has simply been sitting in the counting house with his what he thinks is solid and substantial, money. And Scrooge thinks the same way. You know, money is the only substantial thing, but actually it's the imagination that's the most substantial thing. It's the imagination that creates everything. This is what he's been lacking. And so this is what the ghosts will be teaching you. There's sort of a random thing that when he's talking to the ghost of the Christmas past, the ghost says, your own feeling tells you that you are not what you are, that you were not what you are. So the notion of feeling, as I just was indicating, is the key. As Neville says, titled one of his books, Feeling is the Secret. You know, they create the image, you dwell on it, you love it, and thereby give it reality in the future. I just wanted to close that off a little bit because, of course, when he gets to the spirit of the future, there's a passage there where he sees the people in the stock exchange talking about somebody who's just died, and he hasn't figured out that they're talking about him yet. And so his first grasp at the idea is to think that, I'm not there because I've changed my way of life. And he says, he had been revolving in his mind a change of life and thought and hoped he saw his newborn resolution carried out. So what Scrooge has been learning is that he needs to reimagine a new future if he's not going to wind up dead and unmourned, even figuratively dead. He needs to revivify his life. Another aspect of the house that's very interesting is that before he sees Marley's appearance, his attention is drawn to a bell, which they say had been installed for no known reason to communicate to the upper story, which I think is an indication that Scrooge has not been using his upper story. He has not been communicating with it. He has not used his imagination, in other words. There's a bell there that he's never used, and he doesn't even know what it's for, but it must communicate with the upper story. So for some reason, he doesn't even know what it's for. He doesn't know what his imagination is for. Now, an important aspect of this is that what's very clear is that when Scrooge is reborn the next morning, he doesn't, what he says, he says to the to the ghost, I will honor Christmas in my heart. Well, there we are. That's exactly the idea. Feeling is the secret. But that doesn't mean he just sits around as he did before, but with nicer thoughts in his head or something like that. He acts. you know, he immediately springs into action, starts buying turkeys for people and raising people's salaries and visiting Bob Cratchit and so on. And this is an important point because it's not, the idea is not to sit around and just imagine a good future. You do that until the image is invested with love and warmth and so on in reality. And then you dismiss it from your mind. You go back to sleep. You settle into sleep. And you begin to act on it, right? This is what Scrooge does. He, you know, as the Epistle of James says, faith without works is dead. So the idea is not that you imagine, if you want, you know, Neville wanted to visit his family in the Barbados, but he was too poor to afford the tickets. So he used his method. This is the first time he uses his method. And he did not imagine himself magically levitating to Barbados. He knew he had to get money, buy a ticket, and take a boat. So he acted on that assumption and proceeded. So it, as I say in the New Thought movement in the U.S., help comes through accepted channels. You know, if one believes in faith healing or something like that, it doesn't mean that you ignore medicine, but you engage in it with a positive attitude. You know, Henry Ford was a great believer in the power of positive thinking, but that didn't mean he just sat around and imagined Model Ts. But he went about creating them with the firm conviction that he would succeed. And that's the takeaway here, really. That's what's needed is not just activism, but activism inspired by a firm conviction of what needs to be done. That's the takeaway from Alinsky's rules as well. That's the path of the left is to imagine a future and act in order to create it. Scrooge does, as Scrooge, be like Scrooge. Change your attitude, celebrate Christmas in your heart, but that means go out and do something. The firm conviction that this will succeed.
It's, I don't know if you noticed this spirit, James, or spirit, but a lot of people who are white nationalists or reactionary or dissident right, although I tend to agree with Jim that dissident does sound a little low testosterone, let's call it. A lot of people approach this with, and I've heard the same exact verbatim quote from a lot of people with that this is our honor, and though we may fail, we do this, right? Like the soldier at Pompeii who was enveloped by ash because nobody thought to relieve him from this post. And I understand the feeling. It appeals to me as well, my sense of honor, which could be misguided, could be right. But I always felt that it added this negativity to our way of thinking. I also like to say to people, I don't participate in the normal economy because I don't believe in playing unwinnable games, right? But right. I do participate in white nationalist politics. Again, I do not play unwinnable games. I only play winnable games. I don't do this just because it is my duty and nobody thought to relieve me. I engage in white nationalist politics. I write for Countercurrents. I host this show. I do whatever I can from all the way in distant Macedonia because I believe this is a winnable game. This is a game worth playing. And I think that it's good and honorable to play it for me, for you, for everyone else. We should approach, and this is why I tell people, the positive visualization in politics is necessary. I tell people you cannot be an activist without a positive vision of what victory looks like. I know what victory looks like. I can see it. I love what Kramer says to Jerry when he decides to move to California. In my mind, I'm already gone. Yes, in my mind, I already live in the ethno state. I already live my life. In such a way as to, of course, I mean, I avoid non-whites when I see them. They are a criminal bunch. But in my mind, I'm already there. And of course, I'm not just sitting around doing nothing. I'm doing this every week. I'm writing. Right. I'm fundraising. I'm encouraging people to do more. Every day, be hustling for white nationalism. But you can't just do it with, you know, negative thinking or, oh, it's my duty. I'm going to die at my post. Well, I'm okay. If it comes to that, so be it. But I would prefer to live at my post. I would prefer to win at my post. You know, a soldier going to war, yeah, he would die for his country. But I like what General Patton said about that. The object of war is not to die for your country, but to make the other bastard die for his. That's positive thinking. That's very positive thinking. Yeah, make the other bastard die for his country. Why should we die? Yeah.
Right.
You should win. Another one from war and politics. Reagan. I hate these lose-lose scenarios. How about we win, they lose? I'm all for that. I support that.
Yeah.
I like winning. I don't like losing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. As I sort of alluded to before, I mean, Neville strikes me as his actual life strikes me as being a very model for Aryan manhood. He came to America to enter entertainment and. Eventually discovered metaphysics was more interesting, but he created a nice little life for himself. You know, there's no, you know, asceticism here. He's very involved with life, with marriage and family. You know, compared to a lot of the, strange people who inhabit, you know, as you were speaking with Jim Goad before about the numerous strange people who seem to inhabit the world of the dissident right, we could use more people like Neville. I suppose if I wanted to pursue it, I could probably investigate Kanye's career and speeches and whatnot, and probably find plenty of traces of Neville in there. He seems like a high IQ kind of darky, and there's probably some Aryan thought there. I bet you could find a lot of examples of him saying, "Oh, I just decide what I want to do. I got a picture in my head, and I'll follow it." Actually, one of
I doubt it. I mean, a lot of these blacks they are put in front of us by malicious actors. Let's call them. And a lot of these people, I guess they are driven not so much, like we mentioned, there is the Alinskyite inversion of Evolian visualization. A lot of blacks or non-whites in general, they are driven by a hatred of us. It's something I don't think people understand, that maybe the Aryan way of thinking is you think about a specific positive vision, you shower it with love, and you act towards it. But maybe the anti-Aryan, the non-white methodology, is negative. You find an object of hate, you freeze it, you polarize it, you isolate it. You know, the Alinsky thing.
Yeah.
No?
Well, it's South Africa.
So I'm not sure if Kanye could tap into the power of positive visualization as well as we could, because he is a, let's call him a non-white, you know. He may be driven, and Jim Goad mentioned that this latest crusade against the Jews may be driven by a hatred of a specific Jew who is now cuckolding him.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, well, South Africa is an example. Which you know, the movement was basically hate whitey, and they've never been able to actually construct anything afterwards. I mean, the government is still basically built around the idea of hating the Afrikaner. You know, death to the Afrikaner. When they finally kill the last one, you know, what will they do? Well, they'll turn on each other probably. You know, I mean, there's always an enemy. There's a successful nationalist movement, if you will, built on hate. As Neville says, feeling is the secret, and you know, you know, different racial types will have different ways of heating things up, if you will. Yeah. This is
hate is a very powerful emotion.
Yeah,
feeling
exactly.
Maybe the thing, but hate, resentment, jealousy. Like if Kanye is jealous enough of this particular Jew, you know, that might extend. He may lend his energy to the anti-Jewish effort for his own reasons, obviously. But
well, this is why, as I alluded to earlier, Neville bases his stuff on the Bible, although he interprets it in his own way. And this is probably why Jesus says things like, you know, love your enemies or do good to those who do bad to you and so on. The point is that, you know, in the way Neville would interpret this stuff metaphorically and so on, I mean, Jesus is someone who can rise to the level of the imagination. And one of the things that keeps you from doing that, from ties you down, is, you know, resentments and hatreds and so on, which you know, keep you focused on, well, guess what? Keeps you focused on your enemies rather than, you know, so that's the idea, you know, I mean, just drop it, as Jonathan Bowden would say, you know, step over it. You know, don't sit around plotting your revenge. Forgive them, you know, let vengeance belongs to God. God will take care of it, right? You don't have to do anything. I mean, in some ways, it sounds like a suicidal way to arrange a society. But I think, you know, Neville would give it this metaphorical sort of interpretation or a spiritual sort of interpretation. You know, as I was saying before, you know, Scrooge's house that has the means of communicating to the upstairs, but he doesn't know why it's there. You know, you have to rise up within yourself. You know, Jesus talks about that all the time, rising up. And you know, Christians will tell you it's about, oh, it's about resurrection, and he went up into the sky and all that. No. It's about rising above it. It's about, you know, rising to the level of the imagination and taking care of affairs there, rather than being, you know, sitting around stewing in resentment and vengeance and so on, you know.
Which is why,
yeah,
if
you're sitting around saying, I'm going to get that Jew who stole my wife, you know, I mean, well, you know, you're going to, you know, maybe find yourself in a campaign where you're claiming to go DEFCON 3 on the Jews and so on, and then everything just blows up in your face and you become a penniless buffoon.
Exactly. You might find yourself on Alex Jones.
You may find yourself on Alex Jones. And you may say, how did I get here?
You're talking to a net and a Yahoo box. And okay, that's a very lame pun, but I think he has children, so he's allowed to make it. It's in any case, this is why I say to people, right, we got to learn to love white people. We got to learn to love white people. That's the first thing, right? We are not in this because we hate other races. I actually don't hate other races. I make a point whenever possible to say some positive things about them. I mean, there's not many positive things about them, but I do point them out every now and then. But that's what I'm in for. I'm in this thing for the good of white people, for the well-being of white people. I'm not in this for racial revanchism or historical revanchism. I do believe in historical revisionism, but that's out of my commitment to the truth and not out of revanchism. We have been getting donations, Spirit. So let me just check my donation.
Oh, that's scary.
That is very terrifying, yes. I may bring out my Dracula voice, especially for this. Okay, no, that's the Halloween voice. Sorry. It's getting light. We have $5 from 1980s Chrysler Cordoba. That's a very specific name.
Yes.
And he says, on Odyssey, fantastic stream. Love your streams with Tim. Well, I love my streams with Tim too. And thank you for your donations. Merry Christmas, 1980 Chrysler Cordoba. That's a fine automobile, if I may add. Recently saw a Buick in the street. That's very interesting how older cars look so nice. We have also $20 also on Odyssey. Reed Johnson, Merry Christmas, Nick, and thanks for hosting this Christmas special. If folks wish to donate to this year's Countercurrents fundraiser, keep the lights on for 2023. Go to countercurrents.com/donate. Every bit helps. Merry Christmas, everyone, and thanks for joining us. Well, Merry Christmas, Reed, and thank you for reminding people to donate to the cause. Yes, of course, we will be sitting around positively visualizing everything, and but you will also need to donate, and we will also need to do the heavy lifting here. I like this idea. I love this, that Jordan Peterson had this self-authoring course like a million years ago. And of course, you shouldn't pay Jordan Peterson, how much was it, $250 to self-author. You can just self-author right now. Just visualize using the methodologies here described by James, and you can read about them in more depth for free on Countercurrents, right? Although we appreciate donations.
And in my excellent books, which are not for free, but they are available.
And they are very affordable, I might add. They're not $250 a pop.
No. Let me point out one of the admirable things about Neville. Actually, his family started out with a grocery store in Barbados, and he claims, at least, that using his methods, his father and his brother eventually built it up into what is even now today still existing, the largest conglomerate in the Caribbean, Goddard Enterprises. Mm. And was a privately held company, so he lived off his dividends from the company. I know this because he talked about it in his lectures and pointed out that during the Depression, they never reduced their dividend, which many American corporations had to, which for non-financial people is like the worst extremity that a corporation can be in, is to reduce the dividend, because it's all about dividends. So he did not need a source of income, really, other than that. So he never charged for anything. I think there was probably a small fee for, to pay for renting a hall. And so he gave lectures. And when he gave lectures, he let people line up tape recorders at the front of the stage and record everything he did. He charged for his books. They were small books, and they're all out of copyright, so the internet is filled with them. Transcripts, tapes of the lectures, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is, you never charge for anything. There's no $250 for a self-authoring authoring course. He was also against tithing. That's another thing he thought was being misinterpreted. It was about the use of the imagination rather than giving money to some preacher. So he never, Mitch Horowitz says, there's no membership fee. There's no t-shirt to buy. There's no buttons.
Which for a lot of people is just going to ruin the experience, because people like buying buttons and t-shirts and mugs. They're a uniform, and people like belonging, and a uniform makes you feel like you belong.
Well, anyone could create a Neville mug, I suppose, sell it on Amazon. Maybe right. I'll try that. What would a Neville mug be? He had a sort of a monogram that he sometimes used on his books, which was a heart with an eye inside of it.
Right.
But
with an eye inside of it. Wow, yeah. That sounds like something a menopausal woman would have on her mug. Please don't do that. If you sell them on their false name, I don't want to have my name in any way associated, even if I just had the guy on my show. Please don't. I'm sorry. I'm sure there's a method behind it, but just sounds long, so...
It's a long... It's a long, honored, eldritch... Hermetic symbol going back to the Egyptians and so on. It's actually a hieroglyph. I think a version of it is one of the hieroglyphs. But anyway, my point is, you could slap that on a mug and sell it, and there you go. Yeah, but otherwise there's no entrance fee. There's nothing to buy. And but you're right. I mean, a lot of people, you know, psychoanalysts, Freud himself justified charging for therapy, charging a lot of money for therapy, charging people for therapy appointments they miss. And so on, right? You can't cancel an appointment. They'll just charge you for it. And that's what he said, that people would not be serious if they didn't, if they weren't invested. Of course, another way to look at it is that's the fallacy of sunk costs.
You know, like you can use to direct your thoughts. It's, which is why I always pay my gym membership up front. That way I'm motivated to never skip a day at the gym.
Ah, that's how it works. That's,
you can use, like, a lot of these fallacies. People think they're odd. They serve as gotchas for internet debates. No, they are tendencies of the brain, of your brain as well, because we're all human. We're all fallible. And the Green Knight will nick our necks. And you can use them for good. These are superpowers, essentially. Yeah. In some ways, there are rules of nature. We use rules of nature to run our machines. We should use these same rules of nature to run our lives. I was going to say, however, as we touched on with the ghost of Christmas present, Mr. Jim Goad, there is no great man coming to see us. Kanye has fizzled out. Elon Musk has fizzled out. We have to author our own future. Yes. And that is, I believe, the most important takeaway we can have from this segment and from the show as well. So, Spirit, you have anything to add before we bring the show to a conclusion?
Well, I think that's an excellent conclusion right there. That's what Bowden was saying in that quote at the beginning there. That's the message of Christmas Carol. And as you were saying, you know, it's what Jim was saying and Catherine was saying and so on, you have to, you know, and that's what Neville is saying, you know, that this is what you're doing anyway. Your subconscious is shaping your environment right now. So take conscious control of it. And, you know, as I was saying just now, he never charged for anything. So he would give you this, he would outline this method, and then he'd say, I'm not going to try and prove it to you. Go home and try it. I'm not charging you a dime. Just try it. You know, how much are you losing? Nothing. See, that's the other way to put it. You know, I mean, if you're not paying for it, well, go right ahead and try it. You know, you're not losing any money because you haven't paid any money. So just do it. I think that would make a great slogan for if we wanted to sell a product, wouldn't it? Just do it. Maybe have it like a little swoosh sort of logo. That would be good. Yeah.
We should name it something positive. We should call it Victory.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
Or maybe you know, because victory is a little pedestrian. Let's try one of those dead languages like Greek.
Yeah, get one of those college boys we got on retainer to give us a Greek word for it.
Yeah, what's Greek for victory? Nick? Yeah,
Nick. Nicholas. Nyx. Oh, that's it. Nyx. That'll be our...
No, that's the river of death. Don't tell anyone, though. It's one of those... I think it's the goddess of the night, but it's... There's a story behind Nyx, but it's one of those stories for another day.
Nyx, sticks and tricks, yes.
But thank you for your vision into the future, Spirit. And I think, yeah, that now it's time to bring it to a close. I guess this has been the Christmas special edition of the Writer's Block.
Yes.
Scary. Were the ghosts scary in A Christmas Carol? I've only seen
that's
the film.
A very good point. I refreshed my memory of A Christmas Carol, not only by reading it, but by taking a look at the authentic Alistair Sim 1951 version, which I was glad to see people on the internet continue to hold as the gold standard for that. And they were pointing out that that the ghosts in that are, if you're a child, of course, are really scary. And watching it again, I could see, yeah, they're pretty scary. Marley does a lot of howling, which he doesn't really do in the book. I mean, he doesn't, you know, Dickens doesn't have, ooh, or anything like that. But Marley, he gets out a number of wails that are quite startling. Right. And the ghost of Christmas, well, the Ghost of Christmas Future, myself, of course, is pretty scary because, you know, in the film, they're able to do it with like the robe that's like, you don't see anything. It's like totally black. Dickens says it blends into the night. And if it weren't for the bony arm extended, you would not even see it, that there is something there. So yeah, they're pretty scary. It's definitely got a Halloween sort of thing. And somebody was saying, you know, that was the brilliant thing that Tim Burton had, that they realized that you combine Halloween and Christmas, and with the Nightmare Before Christmas. So
that always felt a little unfinished to me. I always joke around.
Put some flesh on those bones. That's
right. Right. I joke around that Nightmare Before Christmas is a Mike Judge film because the setup is brilliant, but there is no resolution. Because that's something you notice about Mike Judge films.
Mm.
The setups are always brilliant. They're works of pure genius. But then you realize the guy probably finished it, concluded it, because and you realize he bit off more than he could chew. In Office Space, you see this. In Idiocracy, you see this. And in Nightmare Before Christmas, you see this. That this does not, that the end does not do justice to this, to the concept, to the beginning. And it's a shame because I love Mike Judge and I love Nightmare Before Christmas. But that's something to think about, I guess, another day.
Another day. Well, a whole podcast on Mike Judge.
Oh, there's so many things, Spirit, but
that don't end properly. Ooh. Movies that don't end properly. Oh, that's scary. You don't think that's scary, kids? Oh, my.
I'm personally terrified. Yes, I've gone number two on this chair. I'm going to have to buy a new one. But I guess this has been the special Christmas edition of the Writer's Block. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey. And tonight we've had, oh my God, we have missed a donation. Ryan, we have ABC for $10 American over on Entropy. I'm sorry for missing that, Mr. ABC. He asked how imagery and visualization can help athletes reach top performance, for example, well-documented methodology. That's what you're talking about, right? Only in a different level, community level, that requires an entanglement mechanism that would synchronize the individual with the community. That is an interesting notion, Spirit. Do you have anything to answer? I think this is your wheelhouse.
Well, he's right. He's right there. It is used by athletes. Mitch Horwitz, who's sort of cornered the market in Neville books and things, and is also a general historian of the New Age movement. Heard about Neville from a baseball player. I think it was Sammy Sosa. I can't recall, but it was some well-known baseball player he was interviewing. And he said, and they started talking about positive thinking, you know, because Horwitz is a historian and was interested in the area. And he said, you ought to read this Neville guy. And so that's how he actually found out about it. But yeah, there's also some of Horwitz's more recent books, and also a book called Real Magic, which detail actual scientific studies about the use of visualization.
I don't think that's controversial. I'm wondering more about the part where he says
the entanglement?
Entanglement mechanism that would synchronize the individual with the community. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yes and no. I too found that an interesting part of his comment. I too am interested in that, but I'm still thinking about it. that is a research project. How all these apparently different wills are synchronized. To create the world that we see around us. I mean, obviously, the world we see around us is created by all of these various wills. So there's it puts limits on things. I mean, you know, one gets into all these little details and things and so on, you know, I mean, don't visualize having that house because, you know, the family living in there wants to keep it. And there's five wills against yours, you know. You know, visualize the house you'd like, right? So there's no competition. Wallace Wattles from the turn of the last century is one of the big positive thinking chaps, or New Thought, as they called it. Has a book called The Science of Getting Rich. And he talks about, he was a socialist and ran for governor of Illinois, I think, on the socialist ticket. Because he thought that positive thinking, New Thought, and so on showed that you didn't need competition. People didn't need to compete against each other like these social Darwinists hold. And so you would visualize your goal, and that would change reality at a fundamental level, resulting in all kinds of things happening to bring it about. You know, people would discover gold. People would decide to build an irrigation canal just where you need
good,
it.
Good thing nobody told them about opposing wills, huh?
Well, the idea is to get them on your side. That's the thing. So they're not really
right, no, and that's where the gulag comes in.
Well, this is where you know, I was saying about Neville, you know.
See, that's the thing about socialism. It's socialism. I'm sounding like a boomer. But that's the thing about these utopian type ideas, right? They work great in theory until you encounter opposing wills and, oh, you got to educate them. Well, you got to do a little gulagging. And, you know, it's all good and well to have positive visualization and to have will. But remember, there's always opposing will. We visualize the white ethnostate. That is in opposition to the people who want non-whites here. And unless you're willing to encounter some opposition and do things to do away with it, then I'm sorry, you're not tall enough for politics. It's something that people need to realize because this is a serious matter.
I think
he's asking how we can, as you know, white nationalist people, pool our collective will together to strive towards a common goal. And my answer to that is to create a culture, a salon culture, if you will, a means of communicating with each other and of directing our will towards a common goal, which is what we're trying to build here at the Writer's Block. Or, you know, we have visualized ourselves creating a salon culture for the white nationalist sphere, and we are acting towards it.
Indeed. And as I said in my fundraising appeal a few weeks back and so on, that's where you come in, potential donors. You know, we've set up the mechanism, and now you need to do your part. So that's the coordinating that needs to be done. You know, we set it up. It's here for you to enact. And you may find yourself suddenly inspired to send some cash, some donations along the way, for a better future for our people.
Indeed. And I guess with that, third time's the charm. This has been the Christmas special edition of the Writer's Block. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey, and our guests tonight were the ghosts of Christmas past, sometimes known as Catherine S., the ghost of Christmas present, sometimes known as Jim Goad, and the ghost of Christmas yet to come, sometimes known as James J. O'Mara. No moan?
Whoa,
I'm scared. And I want to thank everyone who tuned in live. I want to thank everyone listening to the replay. You are why we do this. We are building a better movement. We are refining the methodologies of white nationalism. And this is one of the ways we do it. We do this for you. I want to thank everyone who commented in chat. It's encouraging to see people engaging with the content as it's being produced. I also rely on this chat to keep things lively. Sometimes, you know, I run out of energy. Sometimes I run out of steam. But whenever I can, I rely on my community to keep me back up. But, you know, we rely on each other. Together, we are very strong. Individually, we are weak twigs, but together. It's called fascism, I think.
Yes.
I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank everyone. You're the one. You're the ones who make this thing possible, who makes this entire operation, this project, this vision, this calling possible. On Entropy, on DLive, on Cash App, doesn't matter. As long as the money gets to where it needs to be, gets to the work, to do the work it needs to be done. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Gadius Maximus, Bartleby, and Reed Johnson, for keeping the chat safe and for keeping everyone abreast of all of the relevant links. Guys, I wouldn't be able to do this without you. And of course, one time I did have to do it without you. I completely floundered. So you get the idea. And with that, I guess, yeah, that's it. Bye-bye. And Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, y'all.